number 5, side 2, review of communications, U.S. Coast Guard Cutter Itasca, and we're interviewing W.L. Sutter, Captain, United States Coast Guard, retired. And Captain Sutter was a junior officer on the Itasca and communications officer during the period June-July 1937. We'll try and pick up where we left off just before the other side.
Well, war material, boy, I'm not talking bombs. Like they had constructed several large tanks for fuel. After a certain date this treaty was signed, they didn't have the oil tanks filled. They were using for warehouses. Could fill the oil tanks would be war material. So it ended up the Ontario, which was down there when the treaty was signed, was a coal burning tug. You know, that's all. They couldn't put an oil burning ship down there because she didn't have any, she couldn't be fueled. So the treaty expired when we were down there, and it was with Japan, I think, and somebody else, maybe Australia. So they were going to see what their reactions were about putting oil in down there.
And they were going to put oil in and just see what happened.
Right. And so they had us down there, and nothing happened, so they started.
Did a ship come in and unload while you were there, or?
Well, the Monterey and Mariposa, we come in there on our way to Australia. We go to Honolulu in Australia.
They wouldn't bunker there, though, would
no,
they?
No, no. One of the reasons we stayed there, another reason we stayed there was that we were running low on fuel, so we had to fuel from one of them. I forgot the Monterey or Mariposa.
They'd meet you there.
That was the only once we did that. And before they arrived, we ran into a hurricane down there. We didn't have enough fuel to go to the sea. And so we had to stay in
between. Oh, you had to stay in
the bay.
Triangle.
Yeah. We had to be, and they wouldn't let us stay alongside the dock because they thought we'd win on the ship and pull the dock down. So we had to get underway. And I remember Mel and I, the captain was up there, Captain Brown, that in probably about a 5 hour, we weren't actually on the bridge, we were standing behind the bridge.
How you say behind the bridge?
Well, you have a wing of the bridge and then you have a ladder going up to the bridge. We stand behind and we'd get in on the action. The captain was calling the ship.
Oh, and he didn't want you on the bridge?
No.
You wanted to see what was going on here, at least.
Yeah. And you know, I guess it was about a 4 or 5 hour period. Smoked almost a carton of cigarettes and about a gallon of coffee. But you could see all these tin roofs going by. I mean, the rain was almost like being under a waterfall every once in a while.
Now, were you at anchor?
No, we were underway.
How did you keep in that heavy rain from running?
Well, we were just lucky. I mean, we didn't have radar. Yeah. But it was too deep to anchor.
I see.
I forgot how deep it is.
The beach is really deep,
though. Yes, it's deep. But then, as I say, finally, either the Monterey or Mariposa came in, and we refueled. And that same hurricane had hit Swain's Island, knocked all our coconuts.
I've heard of this now.
Huh?
I've heard of this now, that a hurricane hit there.
Yeah. And
you tell me the best stories I've heard about this part of the trip so far.
Well,
Black in the meantime had come out, and then Herr Meyer had to go through the whole bit about camp sanitation and cleaning the beach people on the way down. And then we had sent in several of our people ashore. They had windmill generators down there, and some of them had corroded and had to set up their repair of their the generators and the windmills. And they put new equipment, some of it like batteries, which had deteriorated, like they couldn't use them. So it was almost an operation starting all over again, although there was some equipment we could salvage.
Those windmill generators he was talking about were later replaced, I believe, before the point in time in question in June and July 1937 with gas-driven generators. I'm not absolutely positive of that, but I believe the gas-driven generators were used to charge the batteries by the time the Amelia Earhart thing got going in June, July of 37. I've never seen a picture of the windmill generators, but sounds very practical, and I don't doubt that that's what they did use back in 35 and 36, possibly as late as June, July 37. But I do have photographs of gas-driven generators. I can probably tie that down a little later if necessary.
You mentioned the Ontario when you were down there. It was coal-fired. Did you know any of the officers on the Ontario?
I knew the skipper. While we were down there, Mel and I took a side trip over to Pia. They used to have a mail boat around between Tango Tango and Pia. And I don't remember. No, it must have been another storm. Anyway, it sunk, but the guys held on to it. It was a wooden sailboat. They got the Ontario to carry the mail back and forth. The mail would come in to Tango Tango, and then they would take it over to Pia. So we made a trip over there, and this captain then, his name was Wirth, W-I-R-T-H, I knew him. And I think he was the only commissioned officer aboard. The rest were warrant officers. I don't remember.
It was a very junior station.
Yeah, it was. But Wirth later was a public information officer in the 12th Naval District when I was stationed in the Coast Guard. I saw him once again. I have no idea where he is.
Is he of any age, or is he considerably older?
No, he was older. He was a lieutenant commander, and I was only an ensign.
Oh, not alive today, then.
Because promotions were pretty slow during the war. I know we had... I invited him on a trip to go on the island. His father ran a little store near me, and he had graduated Ohio State and gone into the Army during World War I. 1935, he was still a captain. And that was 12 years ago. He was very surprised that Sweet Nelson was a lieutenant comparable rank with only about 7 years service.
Now, you went a couple days on the Ontario, so you knew what the Ontario was about then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The only reason I mention that is because later on the Ontario was kind of acting guard or something
right.
About halfway between Ley and Howland.
Right. I don't think Worth was on there because they had a rather short tour of duty. I want to say only a year. So he might not have been.
But when they were talking about the Ontario being there, you had a pretty good idea about what the Ontario was like and what its capabilities were.
Mm-hmm. She wasn't a very large target.
She was coal-fired.
I remember very clearly because down the engine room, the temperatures got up around, the fire room got up around 130, 135 degrees, and the firemen could only stand on watch 20 minutes. They had to come up to get relieved.
I can believe that. Okay, then, do you remember that on the cruise down...
Now that was the end of what we'll call tape number one, done with WL Center on June 24th, 1975. The rest of the tape was more or less about the trips to Samoa and some of the adventures on Swain's Island and whatnot. And we'll go to what we'll call tape number two during the same interview and pick up from there.
Side one, tape number two, interview with Captain W.L. Sutter, and we are at his office at 346 West 17th Street, New York City. We're on the fifth floor, and I'm sitting here looking out of a porthole at the window in the National Maritime Union building here, and framed in the porthole just beautifully is the Empire State Building. It's a nice setting. Captain Sutter is nice enough to more than take up more time than he ever dreamed he was going to with me, and I'm watching impatiently to see how impatient he gets, but it's 10 minutes after 12. I'm reminding him of the time.
Well, but probably about 12:30.
All right. We've got a limit set on us now. And he was telling me about when the ship was in American Samoa, and he just mentioned before that tape number one went out that The going rate for a girl's favors was a can of salmon, and unfortunately, the ship's stores was being raided surreptitiously by various members of the crew, and they were just about fresh out of salmon, and he remembered one fellow in particular.
Well, he came back with his can of salmon, and he wanted me to open up the canteen. He wanted some Listerine, antiseptic. And I said, well, what do you want this? And he said, well, I was up in this valley, and they have what they call feet-to-feet guard down there. They were Native Samoans. They held rank. I think the head man was a bosun's mate first, and then they went down and apprentice seaman. Well, the feet-to-feet guard kicked me away from the spot where the girl was. And he said, so I said to the feet-to-feet guard, what are you kicking me away? All my shipmates are, you're not bothering them. He said, this is the leper calling. So he came back to ship one and take a bath in Listerine.
Oh, beautiful.
And then another reversed one was that while we were down there, two Kresge sisters, the Kresge 5 and 10 in those days, were down there. So one of them was approached by a native Samoan with a can of salmon.
In reverse, huh?
In reverse. And they were waiting for a cruise ship called the Stella Polaris, which was a very interesting one. They would spend a day in port. Every night they go to sea and wake up in a different port, all the way to Australia. They'd go to, they went to Tahiti and I've forgotten other islands down there.
But, skull of?
No, Stella,
S-T-E-L-L. Oh, Stella.
Yeah.
Stella of?
Polaris.
Of Polaris.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, it had been a yacht of the king of Norway.
It had been his personal yacht previously, had it?
Yeah, and he had sold the yacht, but it was very, a very exclusive cruise. But it was one of the nicest ships I served on. Everybody got along very well together.
The atmosphere on the Itasca was great.
Very, very relaxed, of course. Kenner was a very low pressure. I mean, he had a very good sense of humor, so he contributed a lot to it.
He didn't necessarily believe too strongly in the loneliness of command.
No, that was one thing. That if you were temporary in command, you could not occupy the cabin. So
lived in the wardroom.
He lived in the wardroom all the time. Right? So, he was very easy to get along with. He was demanding, but in a nice sort of way.
Is it sort of true in the Coast Guard of those days that if the captain was super strict, it was almost required that the executive officer be a counterbalance.
Right.
And if the captain was rather lenient, it was necessary for the executive officer to be the, you had to have a Scrooge in it.
That's right. You had to have a strong captain, not a weak executive. But if you got two weak ones, you had a bad house, and you had two strong ones. Or if you had a weak captain, you had to have a strong executive. But you had to counterbalance them. But, you couldn't have two strong.
One guy had to be the heavy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Somebody had to be the heavy on the ship.
Yeah, somebody had to say no someplace along the line. And, well, still that way in good number of ships.
Well, Captain Frank Kenner, he at that time more or less took over when Black was gone, and Kenner, made all the cruises up until his transfer out of there, and he was the head man as far as trying to figure out how to get things ashore,
right.
And he had learned much about piloting around there, and he was the continuity of the operation as far as the Coast Guard.
Yeah, that's correct.
For many years.
Although, when the Dwayne was down there, he had a rather bad experience. He had a guy named Roach that he had a reputation throughout the Coast Guard as being kind of a martinet. And so Frankie told the captain, he said, this surf is too bad to go through today. You better stay off from the Baby Bay joint. You better lay off for a day or so till it goes down. Roach said, no, I want to land it today. So Kenner took the boat, coxswain, and he went in the boat, what we call pitch pole, and which means that you get a breaker coming in, and the boat goes end over end like that. We ended up right on the beach. You didn't have these breakers broke right on the beach. You didn't have breakers far out and get into calmer water like you do someplace. And it ended up with his shin bone got jammed up on it, tibia, but pushed his lower part of his leg right up in here. It didn't break anything, but he was in kind of bad shape for quite a while. So he never had a good word for Roach, but I don't think anyone else did.
Roach made the decision to try it.
Right.
And Sock still took over much later. I don't know if you ever knew that.
No.
But he took over from Kenner.
Oh.
In about 39. And 39 and 40 and 41, Sock still was the man who ran the whole thing down.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
No.
I may have some.
My mother kept quite a scrapbook. The other single night, she sent pictures back. And I know I do have a picture. I was looking over, like, within 4 or 5 years. When we were in Tarawa, we were looking for Amelia Earhart. We stopped there, and the British representative there showed us around. I have a picture of the whole party. We're ashore that day. He was a little disappointed in us because we were going all the outer islands without his permission trying to find out the natives of an airplane. But we couldn't get across to this native on an airplane. The iron flying machine, iron bird. So we finally ended up in Tarawa where I forgot what they call him, the British commissioner. He kind of chided us for not coming to see him first. So he got on the underground telegraph. I don't know if they beat cans or what. He found out that she hadn't flown over any of the islands in his group.
He managed, he was pretty well in contact with everything by whatever means of communications they were able to establish.
Right.
We only have another 10 minutes, so I must let you do your work here. Let's talk for a few minutes about some of the things about the Earhart cruise. I'm going to talk a little bit to cover ground in a hurry. Stop me, though, if I say something wrong. You were also in San Diego at the time. Your task was stationed there, and under command at that time, at the exact time, when Commander Thompson was in command, and I believe Lieutenant Commander Baker was the executive officer.
Correct.
The engineering officer was Braswell.
Braswell.
The navigation officer was Swanston.
Right.
And what would be next in after navigation officer? Gunnery officer. That would be...
I was gunnery officer.
You were gunnery officer? And then what was...
I was also communications officer.
So that was a combined gunnery and communications.
Yeah.
So you were right under Swanston then.
I was under Swanston, right. And Mellon was commissary officer.
Mellon was commissary officer. And...
must have had another deck officer. The Norman always had at least 3 in case of 4.
Swanston?
But it might... We might have been short a deck officer, because around that
time... Yeah, you had a couple of good warrants.
We had a warrant, now dead, named Butcher. A warrant post, he made commander during the war. He died. We also had a gunner named Hines.
Yeah.
And I don't know where he is. think he made lieutenant commander during the war. And I can't remember what Hines' initials are.
I have them all. I can look it up. I mean, got his number.
Well, most of our...
Do you think Hines was young enough he might still be alive?
He may be. I doubt it. But we had a very excellent crew. In those days, during the Depression, we had college graduates for seamen because they'd rather go out and sell apples. They would rather be in the service. And of course, all the service had large, long waiting lists, so that crew was a very much above average crew on the whole.
Oh, I see now. Was Stock still, yeah, you were all quite experienced and been on the Itasca quite a while, actually.
Yeah.
Stock still, not being on board, actually kind of shortened you up a little bit, even though he was studying as an engineering officer.
Yeah.
I never thought of that before, yeah. And so being that he was on leave, I made you one commissioned officer short.
There might have been more than one, because about that time, I want to say that we were getting new academy ensigns who were on leave en route, and we had transferred some of the people who had been on there. So there must have been at least one more deck officer, but we used to carry on an average about four. That gives us one could be on leave, and we still could stand a three watch underway. One. Now the navigator didn't stay on watch.
Normally take 4 to 8 watches.
Well, some of them didn't do that. Some we would what we call dog watches, and maybe every third day, and he would take the 6 to 8 watch. Main reason for dogging is if you got 4 on 8 off, you're always staying on the same watch all the time. Nothing gets monotonous. If some are a little more hectic than others, so he would drop in and dog the watch, so we change watches.
Sure, you were in.
Yeah. And he normally took the 4 to 8 in the morning. That enabled him to take his star sights.
Take his morning fix.
Yeah.
And gyro check.
Right. And as I say, sometimes he would take part of the afternoon watch, but not always.
Okay, now, on this particular cruise, you were gunnery and communications officer, and the gunnery officer was responsible for the magazines and all the fire equipment.
Guns.
The communications officer was responsible for the communications department. What departments in the ship were considered under the communications department?
Well, primarily the radio room, about all.
You didn't even have underwater detection gear in those days, did you?
We didn't have radar.
You had a depth sounder. Right?
Yeah, right. Pathometer.
You remember how far the pathometer was, how deep the pathometer in those days?
We'd go up about 1,000 fathoms.
1,000 fathoms. Mm-hmm. But it was so steep there at Howland Island, it wasn't any good for that use because the such a steep mountainside to the island.
Well, what it did, it dropped off very deep. Now, when you use the pathometer, you can get a bottom where you've got irregular bottom contours and estimate where you are fairly closely. But you got to have a change. Here, you say it would drop off to maybe 300 or 400 fathoms. Within, I would say, probably about 150 yards off.
Wow, it's sheer cliff practically.
Yeah, I remember when the Shoshone went aground, the bow was on a rock, and I think it said there were 60 fathoms over astern. So now she was only 250 feet long. So you see,
I get a general idea of the drop off.
Yeah, so their time from the fathometer is good, but where you get a sharp drop, it doesn't. I mean, especially when there's land, I guess.
Well, as communications officer, and gunnery officer, you were responsible for taking the magazine temperatures and readings and keeping the powder dry and everything in working order in case any gunnery was necessary. And as communications officer, you were responsible for the communication equipment, supplies, and personnel. Right. And did you have a, you mentioned a gunner by the name of Butcher. Was he?
No, Butcher was a bosun. Hines
was a gunner.
Hines was a gunner. He did most of the work.
And he was a warrant at that time. And he did most of the work and the gunnery stuff, and you oversaw the head right. chief administrator and liaison between the captain executive officer and
right.
And communications, who was did most of the work there?
Well, most of the work was done by the chief.
Whoever the chief radio
was. Well, his name was Pilarch, just died recently, I think. I saw him in the Navy Times. But he did more of the nuts and bolts work in the radio. We checked the logs and see if they're staying proper log, and then we'd have to supervise setting up our frequencies on on transmitters on right frequencies and things like that. I've been a ham radio operator, so I
mean, before you went into the postcard?
Yeah, so I mean it was completely strange.
What back in Erie?
Yeah.
Got interested in it.
Yeah, back in Erie.
Remember your call sign?
No, I forgot. So I wasn't completely lost in radio. Of course, even at the academy, he had a lot of communication regulations, like the proper procedures. Most of it was CW work, mostly rather than voice, but you had to know what from and to was. The difference was merchant service. We used DE, we used B, BTs, brakes. And you have to check the message. And also, communication officer was in charge of coding, decoding messages.
Oh, you were in charge of coding and decoding the messages?
Yeah.
That's right. That listed man wouldn't...
Not in those days. They can now.
The officer did all the coding.
And there was so little, only one. Now, during the war, we used to have what they call coding boards. So, well, practically all the traffic was encrypted and come in by bail, so one officer couldn't handle it. But now they qualify misdemeanor can be engaged in the ECM.
Okay. I have to let you go, so I want to ask you three or four things. I have to get back to you. I think I've got a pretty good background in some of the cruises. I'll ask you some specific questions about some of the earlier cruises that other people told me about that you were involved in. I want to confirm them with you. And then what I'd like to do the next time I get a chance to talk to you is I would like to go over the maybe Earhart part of the story. And I'd like to ask you three or four questions right now, much to refresh your memory and hopefully...
a lot of it's forgotten in 40 years.
You remember the report of the incident that of the cruise that Commander Thompson turned in?
I wrote the original report.
You wrote the original report.
Mr. Baker, he met at mine. Commander Thompson, he rewrote the report.
No, I'm sorry, would you say that again? I missed it.
I wrote the original report.
Uh-huh.
Baker rewrote mine, and Thompson rewrote Baker. So there were three. And most of the critical material was in that report. It was put in by Baker. Captain Thompson, I didn't feel as being an ensign, I should be saying that. The district did this, the district did that, so...
And Baker, he was the one who felt that in order for... that's the right word I'm searching for. in order to present a true picture of what really happened, if he felt that some of the critical chips fell back at headquarters, he was the one who put it in there. That's
I don't
the way
know
it was.
Either he or Captain Thompson, I don't know which one did it, as I say. My original report
was pretty bland as far as anything off the ship.
I try to make it actually as possible, no criticism.
You didn't draw many conclusions, you just reported it as it came.
I know one party rather critical. I think Earhart had taken off 4 or 5 hours before we even knew if she was airborne. One party was critical of. And I've forgotten some of the other things.
I have a copy of Thompson's report. Do you still have a copy of your original report?
No, I don't have a copy.
Do you know whatever happened to it, or?
I just wrote it out long ago and gave it to the
paper. Oh, the yeoman didn't, or the inspector, the ship's yeoman didn't type it up your report?
No.
Was it all done at sea before you got back to Honolulu?
Yeah, it was all done.
It's almost strange part of that particular report is, as far as my studying the thing was concerned, was that it went to San Francisco, the report did, of course.
And they were our boss in those days.
And it went to the desk of Harold Dobler.
Oh,
which
yeah.
I thought was... He
was communication officer there.
And he wrote the cover for the thing that eventually went to the commandant.
Oh.
And then the commandant, the Coast Guard, decided to make it confidential, and it was confidential for a number of years.
Well, I know Gerner took issue about the confidential part. One reason, it started out confidential.
Oh, it did start out confidential?
The main reason, toward the end, we were getting scooped by these, we knew the newspapers on the West Coast were monitoring these. And we weren't able to tell information. Frankly, I'd see the Navy took over after we searched out 10 days. Lexington came down, one that carried. In order to give Frank opinion, we couldn't do it in plain language, so we're using encryption or good code. So in order to protect our codes, we paraphrase them, but we want them confidential so nobody could break down the conventional, put it back, break the code. That was our main concern, but we started out confidential because there were paraphrase coded messages.
Commander Thompson directed you then to make that report.
I think that came out of San Francisco.
San Francisco said, when you hit Honolulu, we want a complete report, especially communications or whatever.
Just the whole...
We want to know what happened.
Yeah, communication played quite a vital part of the report. I'm not talking now search plan and things like that, but, thought we'd get... We never really did get to put our own search plans into effect. I mean, San Francisco was running the show, and they'd send us off up to the maybe northwest on some amateur had heard some position given to supposed media from a plane. So before we even got to where there was a search, boom, we had to go to the southwest down. So we were like a cat chasing his tail.
Almost like a Keystone comedy.
Right, yeah.
So Commander Thompson through Baker or Commander Thompson directly, you put down everything. I want everything down here that has gone on.
It was all written in I remember the chronological order. I think the critical part came at the end.
Baker looked it over, and did he talk over things with you and change things?
No.
He did it without consultation, more or less.
I mean, he might have said I should have put in something I might have left out or something like that, but he didn't.
He didn't work with you on redoing it. He redid it himself.
Right.
And then he submitted that to Commander Thompson, and Commander Thompson redid it again for the final draft. And then he had his own human type it up, or had the ship's pool to type it up. Now, I want to ask you something about that, in that when you arrived back in Honolulu, after the whole thing was over, Were you aware that Commander Thompson left the ship almost immediately upon arrival and went to meet the Luralene?
I think so. I'm not certain. Because at that time, I think Secretary Morgenthau, and I think he might have, I know he had to go to the Royal Hawaiian, Morgenthau told him to get out there. And he might have gone over there to meet the Secretary of Treasury, because he arrived about the same time we did.
Hey, you arrived just before him, and he went to the Luralene to pay his respects at the ship side, and then came back to the ship, and then later that afternoon went to the Royal Hawaiian and met with the Secretary. Do you know anything about that at all?
No, I don't know.
Well, I'm guessing, you know who was Morgenthau's aide-de-camp at that time?
Yeah, Don McKay.
Yeah.
He lives in Oakland.
In Oakland. I've been trying to find him, and I can't. There's about 35 Don McKays in the phone book, and I haven't.
Well, I tell you, why don't you call the Coast Guard there, because they have a list of all retired officers in their area. But he lives in Oakland, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Or maybe one of the small communities around there. I remember very well. I had known McKay before.
Why do you remember that? I'm just curious.
Well, I met McKay before.
Oh, I see.
And at that time, we used to have short-range battle practice. He was on the Tahoe. So I got assigned a tug. We had hoisted targets on the tug. We had four Navy targets, but we had a Coast Guard pulling. So he said, you better get those targets evened up right, because you can't put them in this way or that way. So he said, you better get a 10-foot stick and pull them right in the bottom.
That was the end of side one, tape number two, interview with W.L. Sutter. We're now going to side two of tape number two.
Okay, this is tape number two, side number two, interview with Captain Sutter. We were talking about the Amelia Earhart coming in at communications, and the last transmission, would you say again about how the circumstances of the last transmission from her were?
Well, I mean, there was a screech on the microphone. I don't know, maybe... she was switching the thing, and maybe got what you do sometimes, when you shift frequency, get a kind of a screech on it. But in my mind, I mean, it's from her.
Sound like something happened right at the last end of the transmission. In fact, Lieutenant Cooper was in the radio room, too, and what was his remark when he heard that?
Well, as I remember, he said, I don't think there was much use looking for her.
And they felt that something had happened right at that last instant, and they'd lost control or something. Her last transmission was about as loud, though, as the previous ones in that area.
Right. That's why I don't think she overshot the album. Had she overshot, I think the signal strength would start going down.
Well, the Lieutenant Cooper, and you think Lieutenant Commander Baker was also in the radio room,
right.
And the reason for not, they haven't sent everybody ashore, none of the officers were sent ashore.
I don't think anybody was ashore.
And the reason for not sending them ashore was you were going to do it?
Well, we could get them ashore. I mean, as I remember, the surf wasn't too bad that day, that once she said she sighted the land, we could have our people ashore. But we didn't want to send any of us. Might have been one of us, but I wouldn't know who it was. But
I want to interject right at that point. I didn't know this was coming up. Anyway, I have Lieutenant Daniel Cooper's report, and in his report, he did go ashore. They went ashore much earlier. They went ashore. He lists all the people who went ashore with him, which included Lieutenant Commander Baker. So Commander Sutter's memory, or Captain Sutter's memory in this point is in conflict with Lieutenant Daniel Cooper's report, and I think it's just a a trick of the memory after all these 40 years.
We don't want to send officers to the sheriff when maybe we're going to have to make a search. We need it all in Washington, on the ship, to make any long search. Which means we have to go in and pick them up and lose time and start the search.
I see. So you kept them on board until she said she was going to sight the island. Then you were going to send the men ashore.
Yeah, Cooper was going to have priority.
I see. And he was actually in the radio room waiting for her to say she'd sighted the island, and they were going to head for the lifeboat.
Yeah.
Do you believe Commander Baker was in the radio room?
I'm fairly certain he was. I know the captain was. The captain was up on the bridge.
He was on the bridge.
Because at that time, we were making heavy black smoke to try to improve our range of visibility.
Have any problem with that?
No. We didn't. A lot of black smoke. And also, he wanted to be on the bridge so he could supervise there. On the bridge, we had what walkie-talkie, but they're more like a portable radio, rather large. So he had communication with the beach that was on the bridge. He didn't have the radio.
Well, the bridge had communication with the beach, not the radio room then.
No, we didn't have communication.
I see. Did the bridge have a similar unit, the T-22 unit, the same that they had in shore, which is a portable transmitter, or were they separate units?
The numbers don't ring a bell. I mean,
but they were the voice. The
Strictly voice. Well, no, great. I'm going to get along.
Let me ask you just a couple questions, and I really will let you go. On shore, they normally set the portable transmitter up in what they call Government House.
That was your little shack.
Yeah. Do you remember where they set Cipriani up ashore?
He was right close by.
Would he have his own tent or something set up, or?
I don't know, frankly.
Now, Cipriani had this emergency direction finder ashore, as port our advanced breadboard direction finder ashore. And what was he using for power to run it?
It was battery power.
It was battery power.
Yeah.
Do you know the batteries come with it, or?
The batteries came with it, but we could use some of the ship's batteries if we run down.
You remember what kind of ship's batteries, or anything special about that at all?
No, they were just standard wet cell batteries.
I'm leading you. I shouldn't be doing this, but were the batteries used, for instance, were they the same type of batteries that would be used for ignition in your guns as far as the...
That was a little different type of battery. I forgot how it was different, but I think it was a little higher voltage than a regular standard battery for firing circuit.
Well, and her signals were quite loud and quite clear. She was quite close to the island, you estimated, didn't you?
Yeah, right, I would say.
What happened? How come Cipriani wasn't able to, the man ashore wasn't able to get a bearing on it?
As I remember, he got one bearing on it. That's all. So I say, I didn't know anything. Phil Lane Matthew was the chief warrant officer. He was communication officer in the 14th Coast Guard District. He had worked very closely with the Navy on secret projects. He could understand Japanese, and they were intercepting Japanese broadcasts that time. So he had good relations with the Navy. And he made all the arrangements.
Matthews?
No, this guy has... Anthony. Anthony,
A-N-T-H-O-N-Y. You know any more than just Anthony?
No, I tell you who knows him, where he lives. He lives in Northern California. Betty Kenner, because he comes out to visit him.
I see. His last name is Anthony.
Matthew.
And he was a Navy...
No, he's Coast Guard born.
Coast Guard born.
But he worked, as I say, he worked very closely with me.
But he wasn't on the ship at the time.
No, he was a communication officer, maybe assistant communication officer in Honolulu.
Oh, I see.
But when we arrived in Honolulu, he brought the gear aboard. Cipriani, I think, from the team, who had been trained in it. So he was Cipriani was not really one of our regularly assigned. None of our people had any training in She got too high at all.
And Cipriani's logs show that his batteries went dead.
And I didn't know that.
Okay. You left Cipriani there on the island, I guess, when you went on your search, because the direction finder was set up on shore and told him to maintain a watch and try and get a bearing on these signals.
That I can't remember. Possibly you did.
All right, well, this has been fascinating. I'm very sorry.
Yeah, that's the end of side two of tape number two. It was the end of the interview with Captain W.L. Center on June 24th, 1975. I find it kind of interesting that he wanted to skip over the part about Cipriani and the direction finder, and the facts as he remembered them conflict directly with the logged and known facts and reported by other people, but there it is for what it's worth. Okay, this is the end of Sutter interview, tape number two. We'll start... We're going to have to go to a new tape now. This will be tape number six of Communications Review, and we'll continue on with Sutter's tape number three. And Sutter's tape number three skips 2 years now and more, up to July 23rd, 1977, and it was done at his home in Plainfield, New Jersey.